Support for Commodity Week Online comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the February 22nd edition of Commodity Week. USDA this week hosted its annual Ag Forum in Washington, D.C. The 96.5 million corn acre should have been positive to the corn market, and yet it finished lower on the week. We'll try to find out why today on Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I am Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk with Eric Rund, Champaign County farmer and Southern Hemisphere farm owner, about crop prospects from Brazil and Argentina and how he sees development of competition from those Southern Hemisphere nations. Our panelists today include Dale Durkles of AgriVisor LLC out of Bloomington, Illinois, and Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find a way to sign up for our free weekend newsletter. Just hit subscribe. If you don't like it, don't worry. Come back and hit unsubscribe. It's that easy. The newsletter is a great one, written by our own Dave Dickey, Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. You can sign up today at willag.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Well, let's start our discussion this way. Mike Zuzolo, USDA, did release through its Ag Forum this week a 96.5 million acre corn production for the 2013 year in the United States. That was much lower than what many in the marketplace have perceived to be a 98, 99, sometimes 100 million acre production. Why is it the case that prices did not rally in Chicago on that news?
I think there's a couple of things probably within Glauber's testimony or his introductory speech that he gave Todd, maybe that turned the attention away from that acreage number. I think first and foremost, he talked a lot, several paragraphs about exports and corn exports in 2013 fiscal year being down about 38% versus last year. He talked a lot about the corn exports being at their lowest level since the early 1970s in volume terms. He also talked about Brazil likely overtaking the United States as the world's largest corn exporter in the crop year 2013. You blend that together with his other part of his speech about how big or how little of a correlation between the weather and the yield is actually in place between drought years and non-drought years, and that the spring means very little. I think these things all added up along with this huge carryover number to tell the trade we're going to have an unbelievably big surplus of corn, and that's kind of how they took it.
Dale Durkles?
Well, I could make it quick and simple and go ditto. Everything that Mike addressed really is true. You know, the other overhanging thing that I think really is playing into the mix this last week and why it didn't have much response was, frankly, the weather. The system we had out in the Great Plains bringing in a good amount of snow, rain into different areas out there and laying down a carpet of moisture for the wheat crop in particular really kind of dampened the enthusiasm in the wheat. And then you go out into the world and we got some wheat that's trading at a discount occasionally to the corn right now, which really has negative implications. as far as the export sector is concerned, India is the one that's really on the hot button right now, and there just was no reason for anybody to chase the corn market when the wheat market was acting so poorly. The other thing with the USDA numbers in particular, and Mike touched on it, you know, when the 96 million acre number was one thing, but they put out a plus 14 billion bushel corn production estimate, and everybody automatically looked at that, and even before they saw the numbers Friday morning for the actual S&Ds, went, you know, it's a 2 billion bushel carryout. Why do I want to get excited?
You talked just a bit about the wheat. Can you follow up with that? Do you think that the trade is missing anything in the wheat market from out west at this point? Are they counting too much, for instance, on the rainfall that has not yet developed out there?
I don't think they're really missing anything at this point. You know, the one thing I've pointed out to people is, I've been on the circuit this winter and I've talked a little bit about it, even with mainstream corn people, because I've kind of pointed out the importance of the winter wheat crop as we go forward this spring. You know, when a crop's dormant, you really can't do much to negatively affect it unless we had had extremely cold temperatures and had some real winter kill issues, which we didn't have. We had a little bit of blowing wind in the far western areas, but we didn't have a lot of that. And so, you know, it really comes back in the wheat. It's, you know, what kind of weather we have when we get to break dormancy or when we break dormancy, because we are going to need moisture at that point in time. The thing with the system we had this week, and we're going to have another repeat here early next week, is that, you know, we at least are laying down a carpet of some moisture for the crop when it does break dormancy. And as we get into March, we really start that process. The other, you know, maybe people are sitting here thinking that, does the weather we had in the last week or so here represent we're finally seeing a shift in pattern too? So I think there's some doubt at this point in time about what's going to happen with the hard red winter crop. Then you step into the fray and go, you know, we can always counterbalance that with acreage of hard red spring up in the plains in Canada too. So there's just this uncertainty of whether really to chase the market. And you have wheat in the world that's still a drag on our export competition to a certain degree.
Mike, our Thursday afternoon agricultural meteorologist has been tromping through Kansas wheat fields for three or four, maybe as many as five decades at this point. He often tells us on that afternoon that this crop went in as poorly as any, and that in his estimation, maybe as much as half of it is not going to make a crop, although it's kind of early to do that. What are your feelings about the wheat?
I think Dale hit a huge point there, and I think you're adding to it here, Todd. I got a really good email. I had sent a morning market brief out to my clients, and one of my colleagues in Kansas, who is represents a very large commercial feeder of livestock and poultry, sent me a reply back, and he said the winter storm this week definitely was a godsend, but we still have a long way to go. I think the thing the market is missing, and this is me talking as much as him, is that the hard red wheat crop is the lack of a stand. The dry fall did not allow much growth, let alone tillering. I think this is where Glauber, to his credit, talked about this in his opening comments when he talked about hard red drought conditions in Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma. They're running 50% very poor and poor combined. That compares with 10% in those states a year ago at this time. So I think if you ask me what is the trade maybe missing, I think it's that right there, that, yes, there's no question the blizzard and the pattern, potential pattern shift Dale's talking about is going to hurt, help the crop that's viable. But this historical issue, I think, as far as the ability of the crop to survive going into dormancy, I think, quite frankly, the trade has kind of lost in the demand and the supply issues of the other complexes.
You know, to fill in with that a little bit, you know, you talked about, you know, they were talking about maybe having up to half abandoned. That may be a bit of a stretch, but all along here for the last month and a half, too, everybody's been saying, you know, 25% of the acreage out there could end up getting abandoned at some point in time. But wheat, you always have to be careful until you really get into spring and breaking dormancy, because it is like a cat that has nine lives, you know, and so it's so hard. And I think that's why people are being very cautious and careful about, you know, being real pessimistic about the crop. At the same time, you know, I don't think they want to be optimistic about the crop. But when you look around where we are here in the U.S. and the kind of crop we could have and where we potentially could be in the world, are we going to have the export demand to really pull it out, you know?
Yeah, that was
pull the market out of the hole.
That was my next question. When you look across the planet, is the wheat crop, Mike, in better shape than it is here in the United States?
I don't think so, based upon, other than India, I think that has been the biggest bearish surprise, in my opinion anyway, Todd. But I think when you look at the fact that we're hearing now that the European Union may be wanting to source U.S. or South American wheat, we now have China as our number two buyer on the weekly export sales. We don't know if Russia is going to import grain. We still have a terrific drought down in Australia heading into their planting season, and you still haven't gotten USDA to rectify either the Argentine numbers because of their crop partially failing this past winter, and also you have the Beijing office of the attaché saying to the Washington office of the World Agricultural Outlook Board, you're 12 million tons too high in production for China's production of wheat this past season. I see it almost the exact opposite. If you take India out and you take out the issue with Egypt and their currency going sharply lower and their buying power going down, I see wheat almost the exact opposite as maybe the market does right now.
Let me have both of you put this into context of corn, old crop and new crop, because, of course, the wheat crop in the United States will come in June and July, so it'll be dealing with both crops at that point.
But you got to remember, we'll have some insight into the wheat crop once we get into the month of March and certainly in April, because it'll be out of dormancy and we'll already have some idea about what that crop's going to look like. And so that's always important at that point. So that's why wheat's hugely important. It's the first crop we plant. It's the first crop that has a growing season. It's the first crop we harvest.
So you want to defer the question until later about the impact of old and new crop?
No, I don't think
I'm just kidding. Yeah, of course.
You know, in one sense, it's a lot like 1996, the whole environment we're dealing with here. If you remember 96, and I've taken a lot of people through this, we had a subpar crop in 95. We had China buying corn crop in 95. We had China buying corn from us winter of 95. We hadn't crossed through the $4 record high yet as we got into March. Everybody in the feed industry here in the U.S. knew we were going to be really tight of corn before we harvested the 96 corn crop. They were counting on a good wheat crop to extend what arguably it was going to be a very tight corn situation. We got into March, and especially into April, the wheat was through dormancy, and all of a sudden the weather turned hot and dry. The wheat took off. We went to 7.5. The lid came off of corn. Corn went to 5.5. You know, that could replay, but if it rains, we could still have sort of an okay wheat crop, and it may not play out this year. But I think right now you can't be pessimistic. That's the one thing I think, not at these prices yet.
Mike?
I think cyclically is what I went back and looked at, and it matches up a lot with Dale. The other year that seems a lot like this year, from a November-December price break all the way into the end of February, it looks like we're going to have this type of a wheat market. The last time I show that we did that was around 2002, 2003. We broke about 35% until March. We then rallied about 39% off of the lows that were set up from the earlier break. And then we took a pause, and then we rallied another 10%, and guess what? We were right back up to the levels that we had broken from the previous September, October of 2002. So by the time we got to the May-June time period, early July time period of 2003, we were trading back up towards the old highs from the previous fall high. And I think that works well from a standpoint of what Dale was talking about in the crop coming around as far as what we will know more about and what kind of situation we find. These next 2 weeks, with the 6 to 10 day forecast being dry and the 8 to 14 day forecast being dry, these next 2 weeks, if that plays out, I think the trade will look differently upon the wheat than they do maybe right now.
Here are some of the numbers as they settled up in Chicago for the week. The July contract for the wheat, by the way, at $7.23.5, we're down 27.5 cents on the week. The March corn at $6.90.25, down 8.5. December at $5.52.75, down 10.25. And the March soybeans were up 36.75 for the week. November beans at $12.66.75 were up a nickel. Why did the soybeans rally this week, Dale?
you know, the big story in soybeans this week really was China coming back off their week-long holiday. Everybody had expectations that China was going to step in and buy. We had market talk all week long that they were going to be in the mix, basically because of continued backlog of ship loadings coming out of Brazil in particular at this point in time, and that's really a function of the harvest getting off the mark slow this year. We were up, but I think by the time we got to the end of the week on Friday in particular, there was some disappointment around. Number one, we'd only had a couple of cargoes that we had noticed they had bought, and we also had some cancellations. So there was some real questions about what's happening.
Mike, your quick assessment of the soybean market?
Well, you certainly need an Excel spreadsheet to keep track of China's bean purchases. We went from a marketing year low in export sales from this morning, so we saw a negative 521 on unknown cancellations, and then all of a sudden, like Dale was talking about, we had heard 500-plus in brand-new purchases. To me, it's about logistics in Brazil, some weather in Argentina, but I'd look for more cancellations in beans, Todd, if we don't have any more port disruptions. I think once they start that and go down that path, we have to put that into our marketing plans. They're going to continue to do that if they can.
This is the February 22 edition of Commodity Week. Our panelists include Dale Durkles of AgriVisor and Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Back in just 2 minutes.
I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser with a look at the weather for corn and soybean production in South America. Some rain fell across Argentina last weekend, but not nearly enough to counter significant moisture deficits, especially in the higher producing areas of the south. Rainfall deficits across southern Cordoba, northeastern La Pampa, much of Buenos Aires, and southern Santa Fe are roughly 1 to 2 inches over the past 3 weeks and 4 to 7 inches over the past 2 months. This dryness is leading to soybean yield losses. Looking at the forecast, a cold front will move into Argentina with showers and thunderstorms this weekend. Once again, the heavier totals are expected for the northern production areas with amounts of 1/2 to 1.5 inches. Meanwhile, rainfall is expected to remain lighter to the south, where it is already the driest, with anticipated amounts mostly remaining less than 2/3 of an inch. Mostly dry weather will follow across Argentina next week, with only a few spotty showers and thunderstorms possible later in the week. Thus, problems with dryness in key Argentina soybean production areas will continue. Temperatures through the coming week will remain below average to near average, so no heat stress will accompany the dryness. In South Brazil and Paraguay, showers and thunderstorms during the past week slowed harvesting and second season crop planting, but helped developing crops. Mostly dry weather is expected this weekend before rain returns early next week. In center west and southeast Brazil and Bahia, mostly dry weather has dominated over the past week and a half, allowing soybean harvesting and second crop corn planting to advance quickly, especially in Mato Grosso. Showers and thunderstorms will become more numerous in Mato Grosso and Mato Grosso do Sul during the coming week, while areas to the northeast will remain dry. That is your South American weather update for Commodity Week. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser.
This is the February 22nd edition of Commodity Week. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Our panelists include Mike Zuzulo, Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He's out of Lafayette, Indiana. Dale Durkles is here as well, AgriVisor LLC from Bloomington, Illinois. Our guest today, Eric Rund, Champaign County, Illinois farmer and a Southern Hemisphere landowner. And a longtime friend of the radio station, WILL. Eric, thanks so much for being with us. A couple of weeks ago when we had Dr. Cordonier on the air, you listened to that program and said, hey, I've been to Brazil and just got back. What he says is true, but you have some different perspective because you'd really been out into the depths and seen some of the clearing of lands and all sorts of things that have to do with production agriculture just beginning to come up there.
Yes, Don, thanks for inviting me. I happened to be invited to go to Brazil by a group of farmers that had been up to visit our farm back in 2010. And out of the blue, he sent me an email and said he wanted to come down and travel with me while I do my rounds. And this fellow is an agronomist and a consultant. We visited about 10 of his clients. Well, this was the first time I did go to Brazil with no group to shepherd around. And so I got to visit a lot more in-depth and in areas that I would never have gotten to go to had I had a group with me. And my first impression, by the way, this time we were in more of the eastern bean belt and through Bahia, a little, and Tocantins, Maranhão, Piauí to the north, and areas that I'd never been to before. And my opinion, first blush, was things look pretty good. Of course, farmers are never happy, and they were said, well, we had a dry start, and we don't think it's going to be as good as it could have been, which probably was true. But the beans look pretty good. The corn certainly looked good to me, just starting to tassel, and the rains had just come on. So there's going to be the first time I've ever visited Brazil when I thought there was going to be 200 bushel corn that I'd seen. And I asked them, well, how, you know, what's your management on this? Because before, fertilizer seemed to be too expensive to haul in. But these guys were putting on 180 pounds of nitrogen and 80 pounds of phosphorus and 100 pounds of potassium. And this is 200 bushel corn. So anyway, that impressed me, and it kind of scared me a little bit too, because I'm a corn farmer. I always thought we'd be growing the corn in the U.S. and let those guys produce the beans, but they're learning how to grow corn too, and they're doing a good job of it.
In your view of what is taking place down in Brazil, because I know they still have a huge, huge amount of land that they can fully develop. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they really are going to be a competitor? Because I know, like over in Mato Grosso, where we've had all the soybean expansion, they double crop corn behind beans now and are doing it successfully. And do you think this is going to be a more common practice up across that northern and maybe even eastern band?
Yeah, I've got my trips I've been in past to Mato Grosso. I've got a number of friends there, and I emailed one before I came in today, and he said we're halfway through with our bean harvest. It's yielding about 55-60 bushels of the acre, and at the same time our corn planters are running. We're going to plant 80% of our land will go back into corn, and that's unusual because in the past he's more like in that 30% range. So they're reacting to a high market. There's no doubt about that. I can see that. On the east side, a lot of beans never got planted as first crop beans. They got a late start, so rather than try to put in a second crop of corn, they just planted 140-day corn right from the get-go, and that's why they're going to see higher yields there mostly. So, high prices are the best fertilizer. I forget what Earl Butt said that, right? And those guys, they take that to heart. You offer $7 corn in the world, and somebody's going to grow it, and these guys have taken that to heart, yeah. So the other thing I noticed, though, that they're having troubles, mainly on the insect side in soybeans. I had visited every farm we'd visited in this trip. They were in that sixth or seventh spraying already between herbicide, fungicide, insecticide, and insecticides were just eating the beans. They had gone through the gamut of the chemical activity on these insecticides, and the ones insecticides that were actually doing any good, they were hard to get and get in a timely manner. The guys were just spraying day and night. And I asked the consultant what he thought of this, and is it this normal? He said, no, this has gotten worse in the last two or three years to where something management-wise, he thought we're going to have to do some changes because you'd probably be able to kill them if you keep spraying, but it's going to be uneconomical to do so.
So has the management changed the double crop to corn to try to control insects? Does that do one of them? And I don't know whether that without much of a winter season, because you're in the mm-hmm. eastern part, right? Mm-hmm. So you're really far north. You're much closer to the equator there.
The rotation will certainly be part of it, and a logical choice there would be corn or cotton. They grow a lot of cotton there too, but yeah, get a break in the cycle, and that'll certainly help them. These were his thoughts, but you could tell farmers weren't sleeping well. You know, you got a good crop of beans out there, and something's eating it up, and you can't control it. You're thinking ahead. What am I going to do the next time around to prevent this? So But their handling as far as getting the crop out, we say, well, there's dirt roads, that's poor infrastructure, which it is, but we were driving on these roads in a downpour. You can get across them. The soil is so sandy and the road's crowned a little bit. You just keep going. It's not as nice, certainly, but a big crop, they can move it. It costs them $1 a bushel, maybe a little more than that, but they can move it, and they're getting the job done. There's few problems with truckers now. The government has placed a limit on the number of hours they can drive. That's going to slow things down, make it more expensive, if you will. But on the flip side, we drove across and alongside the North-South Railroad that's, as far as we could tell, it's complete. In fact, I asked why aren't they running trains, and a couple of guys says, well, it's not quite done on one end, and it's more of a political thing. I don't know what's holding it up from running trains, but that's here. It's coming. And it'll affect us. One guy illustrated it to me. We're going to be able to take beans and corn to a port that's 2,000 miles closer to the Panama Canal than the port at Santos is now. So that'll reduce the cost of getting beans to China is what that means. And so that's going to make their prices better to the farmer. It'll make our prices better. Where our little farm is in southern Africa, Tocantins, we're 40 miles from the railroad. That's going to be a big help for us.
Mike?
I wanted to find out, Eric, your thoughts on gauging how serious or how long this port strike with Santos and Paranagua could last, and kind of the context that Lula just kicked off, the former President Lula just kicked off the reelection campaign of Rousseff. Rousseff is trying to privatize the ports. This is what's ignited this port strike this weekend. Would you think this has got legs to it, or is this just a political thing? What's your insight on that?
Not very good. I would hate to venture a guess on how this will turn out. That always happens, of course, when they need the port the most. But the politics involved in that, I'm really not sure, and I would hate to venture a guess. It would probably be wrong. The desire, though, to increase exports is there. There'll be a new port at the end of this railroad line, and there's talk of other new ports. This rail line will go east-west as well. There's another leg in the works. So Brazil is serious about gearing up on exports. There's no doubt about that. So it'll get resolved one way or the other. May not be some people happy, but it'll get resolved.
Eric, thank you so much for taking the time with
sure.
us today. Eric Rund, Champaign County, Illinois farmer and Southern Hemisphere landowner. Now, time for a final word from our panelists in studio. We'll start with you, Dale Durkholz.
You know, the one thing I think farmers need to really take to heart was the soybean performance on Friday and really watch closely in this coming week. That could have meant the end of the winter rally.
And Mike Zuzalo?
Well, I know we were all wanting a wheat bottom here, Todd, but I'll have to say, too, that the Deese corn, I wonder how much more negativity we can throw at this market with very little weather premium and a 2.1 billion bushel carryover now being traded. I wonder if that Deese corn is not near a bottom, if the wheat can get a bottom in it, too.
Mike, thanks.
Yes, and Eric, thank you for answering that question. I felt like I had to ask that because that's probably what's on everybody's minds this weekend about this port strike, so thanks for handling that so well.
Oh, well. A little long-winded answer. When you don't know what you're talking about, you kind of stretch those answers.
No,
out,
it was
right?
A great answer, especially how you wove that into increased exports. I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good talking to you.
You too. Dale, take care, buddy. Thanks, Todd.
Hey, Mike, as an FYI, you mentioned something about cycles, but both corn and wheat are really in windows where they ought to be putting in some short-term cycle lows.
Do you feel like that's got to come by mid-March or something's really wrong with this market, Dale? Where's your mindset in a big-picture context?
Well, I can't think so much of wheat right now because I haven't looked at the price. The pattern of the decline tells me that we ought to be about done going down. But the corn market, you know, the one thing I look at here that, and it'd kind of be a tip-off, the low we had back in, was that late December, early January on May corn, which is actually the same low as the low we had on the nearby futures chart, and that's roughly at I think it's like 678. Boy, a close below that on Maycorn is death.
Okay.
I actually put out some bean sale recommendations today, and we have a program where we price stuff for farmers. We sold some new crop beans this morning, but I won't sell any new crop corn yet.
I'm in the exact same boat, Dale, and I've been fighting the funds and the commodity trading funds, and they're spreading for, what, two and a half months now. Yeah. It's driving me crazy.
You know, the one thing I think that and this is a big picture kind of thing, and you see it as well as I, because I know what you kind of follow. Money doesn't like commodities in general.
No, exactly.
I mean, look at the gold market.
Exactly.
Money does not like commodities. I was looking at a number of different charts. This was right around the first of the year, just a number of markets, and occasionally I do that like you. And the one thing when I got done, I went, you know, the trade of the year might be sell treasury bond futures.
Oh, yeah, with higher interest rates coming, you mean?
That market to me just looks like death. And if that's the case, you know, it just says, you know, the interest in owning commodities in general probably is not good right now. And that's one of the issues I think we're really fighting in the wheat market and in the corn market. You know, people just don't want to own it. And I mean, look at wheat in Chicago. The hedge funds are net short right now.
Yeah, and see, that's where it's almost like 89. I went back and did research, mm-hmm. and I thought, how in the world could bond interest rates go up and yields go up in a recession? If I'm promoting a recession, how could yields go up? Well, it's exactly what happened to Bush. The bond market got spooked because we started to slide back into recession, and they expected the economy to get worse. So they went in and started selling bonds like crazy. So I think you have a very valid point there, and it does happen in recessions.
The other thing that goes along with this one, and you know, from a fundamental thing, makes it work, is just like the Fed minutes this week. You know, they're debating on ending their bond buying program.
Mm-hmm.
And that just takes a natural floor out from underneath the bond market itself. But I think it's high time that they start letting rates creep higher a little bit, because I don't think rates creeping up even a little bit are going to have negative repercussions on the economy. And in fact, it might actually help, because there's so much money that's being held back that people are afraid to move it and do anything with it. I think if we finally see the rate structure start to change, that it might break the logjam of the money the corporations are holding and get it moving and put in a more productive position.
I think you're 100% right, because the retail investor has not been in this stock market rally. So a bond break and higher yields probably would pressure the stock market, and then the retail investor would maybe come back in again. But they're not going to come in at these price levels.
No, I don't think so. You know, they're going to stand back, you know, where we're sitting here flirting with record highs. They're going to go, nah, don't want any part.
Yeah, and sequestration and all this other talk that's in the news all the time, they're not going to buy at these price levels. So.
The big fear long term I have is, do we end up like Japan?
I know. Well, and that's what I'm worried about the wheat is, are we on that track? Because the Japanese yen is certainly a great indicator for corn prices, or it used to be, and I'm wondering, gosh, if they go down and artificially break their currency to beat up on China's export market, what's that mean for our ag demand? Maybe USDA's right.
You know, that's an issue out there. It's just like, it was yesterday or the day before, you know, there was some news out of Europe. I mean, they ratcheted back GDP numbers for France from 0.4% growth to 0.1% growth, you know, and now you got everybody worried, is the EU going to stay mired in a recession? And actually, if we do that, the only place that's really growing well around the world is China, and China is in trouble if no one else is growing.
I was going to tell you, there is a great article in Wall Street Journal today about a Standard Charter economist that said that they're not using a high enough inflation in China, and if they plug their real inflation in, they only had 5.5% growth in 2012, and they really lay it out nice and have some great charts in it. It'd be worthwhile reading.
That'd be a good one to read. You know, just as you mentioned China and you talk about inflation, I've often mentioned to people that the era we're in right now, to me, is still, in a very broad sense, still like the 70s. I worry about this year ending up looking like 1977, in fact. And I don't worry about that. And you can go back and look at that one on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And then we came back. We had strong markets in 78, 79, and in 80. And I've mentioned this a few different times out there. I said, you know, the thing in the long haul, and I think agriculture is good for another 5, 6, something like that, years. But the thing I'm looking for is, who is the next Paul Volcker?
Yeah, right.
And people look at me and, you know, they kind of think I'm crazy. And I'm going, trust me, Paul Volcker won't be here. What if it's somebody in China?
In China, exactly.
And
you
know,
they start the yields going up and it migrates across the ocean. Yeah.
Or they decide at some point, you know, out here 3 or 4 years, they've got to do something with their inflation rate.
Yep.
And bring it under control when they start tightening up on their policies. And all of a sudden, this growth engine that agriculture has enjoyed going with products going to China comes to a screeching halt. And we're left here with 90-some million acres. And all of a sudden, instead of driving gasoline-powered cars, we're driving natural gas and electric-powered cars. And what are we going to do with all this ethanol? And then what are we going to do with the land that we devote to raising ethanol?
And then Eric's bought 5 times more land in Brazil at that point.
I heard something interesting, though, from on the ethanol side that could develop into something. The two guys I visited with, one guy was a deputy director of biodiesel, the other was ethanol. And the ethanol guy was talking about, we really want to sit down and have some heart-to-heart talks with the U.S. on fuel policy, renewable fuel policy. Said, I think it's 2-3 years ago, Brazil was in Minnesota looking to buy ethanol because they were short. And then this past year, U.S. has been buying cane ethanol to meet their advanced fuel requirement. And then they passed the fiscal cliff legislation that gave us a dollar on biodiesel again, retroactive through 2012. Well, that screwed up the ethanol purchases from Brazil. And now Brazil's short again, possibly, because there's so much money in sugar. You can make sugar cheaper than you can make ethanol, and they may be short ethanol. So they may be back in the United States buying ethanol. And this guy says, we need to sit down and have a serious talk about trading ethanol. It's a worldwide commodity.
Arbitraging it, yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so he really wants to get something going. And with his position that he's in with his, you know, his former boss was the president, he has some clout in maybe moving these things forward. And farmers need to be paying attention to these things that are coming forth, because they're going to affect us one way or the other, I think.
Yeah, and their trade outlook, USDA spoke specifically about Brazilian ethanol competing with us this next year, and that's why they're not too hot on our own ethanol export market. But that would be interesting if Brazil is still refining into sugar. That maybe would not be as much of an issue.
Yeah. You know, and what I don't keep track of sugar market.
They had a very good sugar crop this year.
Yeah. Yeah, the sugar really and coffee crops were great.
And the price, what about price? Because that seems to be driving it.
It's about 18 cents right now.
Is that high, low?
It's on the low end. Sugar's been discounted for a couple of years now, hadn't it, Dale?
Yeah, well, see, they had a problem here, was it last year or the year before? And that's when they were really short ethanol because they had a short crop. World sugar prices were high, so they were really processing sugar and not processing as much ethanol. But this year, with a good sugar crop, or the one that's coming on, they're actually going to probably end up processing more into ethanol. And they were talking on the wires here about it's been a month ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, about raising the portion of ethanol in their fuel blends.
Yeah, pretty
low. Because they actually had lowered that back 2 years ago, and I don't remember the timeline and when
they raised it from 20 to 25.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Eric, do they have the increase in cars and people going from, like China, going from riding bikes and walking to motorized vehicles have this huge energy demand coming in Brazil or not?
There's no recession in Brazil that I saw.
Right.
Uh-huh.
There's cars being bought, and so it's a thriving economy. Cities are growing like crazy. After all the gloom and doom we talk up here of no housing and recession and this and that, you go down there and it's all the other way. It just kind of perks you up again, I guess.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. So, no, there's demand there, and it'll be interesting to see how they meet that demand, because they don't have new reserves. They found something off the coast of Rio way down at the bottom of the ocean, but that's tough to get, that
yeah,
kind of oil.
That's so, deep water stuff, yeah.
So they're looking for renewable energy, no doubt.
And I think China was trying to get locked into their ethanol market to import more ethanol from Brazil, if I remember reading that not too long ago as well.
China has tried to get in from – now, these are just farmers I talked to over a beer, you know, so I don't know how accurate this is, but
right. –
They're talking about China's trying to invest in a port, invest in railroad, invest in land. Well, the government kind of put the kibosh on much investment in land itself. But China's, they're looking to secure food supplies.
A lot of bilateral stuff's being done with China right now and other countries, it seems like. They're really aggressive right now. They're kind of like the Japanese in the 80s. They've got the money. Why not spend it?
Yeah, sure.
Well, it's they also got the demand base, you know.
Yep,
when,
exactly.
When you look at their population, when you look at food and other items, you know, they're trying to secure it. You know, it's just like one of the things that people in this country don't talk about. You know, we're having this big argument about the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, if that doesn't go, you watch. The tar sands, you know, the environmentalists go, we don't want to develop the tar sands. Sorry, folks, it's going to happen, because if Keystone XL doesn't come in and that oil doesn't come into the U.S., guess what? China's going to put the money in, and that stuff's going to go west off the West Coast and across the sea to China.
Yep.
Just what an interesting thing for me personally, because we've been growing miscanthus now for about 5 or 6 years, an energy crop. Well, we ran across the hometown where we stayed for a while, where Bunge processing plant down there, soybean meal processing plant. And they are now buying crop residue. It's actually a cover crop, Brachiaria, which they plant through after the last crop in the spring, and it serves as a cover crop through the off season. Well, instead of burning that off or running cows on or just mowing it, they're baling it up. And Bunge is buying that at a rate price cheaper than they can get firewood, because firewood has to be certified that it comes from non-environmental damaging areas. So they can buy this crop residue much cheaper, and it gives farmers another source of income. So in those years, which we haven't seen in the last 3 years, where a farmer is maybe just getting by or losing a little, he's got that little extra biomass he's selling off to keep him going or to buy a little extra, another tractor or something. So that's and there's power plants the same way. And so much of Brazil, we talk about ethanol, but Brazil runs on biomass. There's much more energy developed from biomass than it is from ethanol for cars. So it's something to keep an eye on.